Paula Harris is an Italo-American photojournalist and investigative reporter in the field of extraterrestrial-related phenomena research. She has a master's degree in education, teaches history and photojournalism at the American Overseas School of Rome. Paula has written for numerous national publications and has been a speaker at several UFO conferences. She has studied extraterrestrial-related phenomena since 1979 and is on personal terms with many of the leading researchers in the field. She has also interviewed many top military witnesses concerning their involvement in the government truth embargo. Paula Harris. Paula, how are you?
Pretty good. It's raining here in Rome, but other than that...
Well, let me tell you, our eastern coast of the United States at about 40 inches of snow. Can you believe that?
We're hearing about it. We saw the photos on the news.
Absolutely incredible. I'm looking forward to tonight's story, by the way, Paula. Charles Hall enlisted in the U.S. Air Force in 1964, and while stationed at Nellis Air Force Base outside of Las Vegas, he served for extensive periods of time in the desert on the gunnery ranges at Indian Springs, Nevada. This service as a weather observer was followed by a year in Vietnam, where he performed award-winning service. And a year after receiving an honorable discharge, Charles married, went on to college, where he earned both a bachelor's degree in thermal physics a master's degree in applied nuclear physics at San Diego State University. Now, in addition, Charles did PhD-level postgraduate work at the University of Maine and later earned an MBA. After Charles had been married for about 6 months, he decided to risk telling his wife about the extraterrestrials that he had encountered at Indian Springs. 18 years later, his wife convinced him to publish what eventually became the Millennial Hospitality series of three books. Charles writes about the Hall photon theory in one of the books. He claims that Einstein's theories fell short and that if scientists accept the hypotheses that he presents, vehicles can be built which will travel faster than the speed of light. And we'll be talking about all of that tonight. Charles, welcome to Coast, sir. How are you?
Oh, fine, and thank you for having me on the show.
Good.
And I wanted to say hello to both you and to Paula. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Charles.
Hey, Paula, how did you get involved with the Charles Hall story?
Well, like everything in my life, it was quite by accident. I happened to be in Roswell, New Mexico in 2003, and I had seen Charles and Marie there. They were selling the book Millennial Hospitality, so I sat down and began to chat with him. And I found him very interesting, and I found that he was telling a story with a lot of details. And I also noted that he had worked on the Nellis base. And I thought, well, this is a person that is a military weatherman that had worked on the Nellis base. The thing that amazed me the most was that the years were 1965 to 1967. So I think I made a mental note of reading the books. When I got back to Colorado, I read the books, and when I read the books, I was astonished with the amount of detail. So I talked to Charles and Marie in Colorado Springs. They have some family there, and I interviewed him at length. When I heard his story, George, I thought I was going crazy, so I called in another person to help me, and that is Frontier Airlines pilot David Coote. I said, David, this story is amazing, but I need a benchmark. I need someone to kind of be with me when I do this story because it has so much detail, and I need to bounce it off someone. So David Coote and I researched the story for nearly a year and a half, and now we have what we have here with Charles's story that David and I thought was very, very worth bringing out. I'm going to add another thing, though, George. In order to bring the story out, it took a year and a half worth of investigation, but we had to find other people that worked on the Nellis base with Charles, and
okay.
We did do that.
All right,
we
that's
did that.
Important.
Yeah, we did do that thanks to the help of Los Angeles Police Department retired Sergeant Steve Natale, who he was the person that actually, after all this effort, could find two other people that worked on the Nellis base that supported a lot of Charles' story, not the extraterrestrial part necessarily, but what had happened, the myth around Range 4 Harry, the fact that, you know, strange things were happening, the fact that Charles worked there, all the little details that Charles puts in his book These people supported and even sent a few photos of their being on the base at that time. So I have a few photos of 1965 to 67, the barracks that Charles talks about. And I'm going to add one more thing. Steve Natale also volunteered a forensic artist of the Anaheim Police Department to do for the first time what we call a composite of the tall white alien teacher. And we want to, even though they're not finished with it, we want to debut that on your website before any place else. So your okay. listeners can wait for that because it will come out. And it comes out with the cooperation of all these different people. Now, I worked with an airlines pilot. I worked with this police sergeant. So I'm working with all different people. This cooperation brings forth this story.
All right, very good. Let's bring in you now again, Charles. If you can tell us a little bit more about your background before beyond what I've introduced you as.
Yes, I'd be happy to. I was born in Wisconsin, and we lived in San Diego, California, and Washington State. As you see, I have a master's degree in applied nuclear physics, and so I've done a great. And I'm a computer expert, and so I've done years and years of experience on nuclear computations and computer computations and so on. What other details would you like?
How did you get involved in terms nof the military? How did you get to Nellis Air Force Base?
It was 1964, and I was single, and I'd gone to the University of Wisconsin for a year and a half and ran out of money. I come from a poor family, and it's a very expensive place. And, you know, the Army sent me a letter, and it said, you pick them or we will. And so I picked the Air Force, you know.
And you went in as an Air Force weather observer. What is that?
Well, no. When I enlisted in the Air Force in July of 1964, I did my basic training, which was 13 weeks, at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, and I was there over August and September in basic training. Which one of the coincidences is I was there over the same time frame that. There was like that big storm that Whitney Scribner refers to.
The global superstorm.
Whatever it was, but I remember I was walking area guard that night during that storm, and I was the only one. All the other area guards got the storm was so bad they took cover and they got a few weeks in the brig for it, and I was out walking in the rain. So my first award was for doing my duty in the rain, and during that time they give you a lot of tests to see what you do well. And
yeah.
I got a perfect score in reasoning, in convergent reasoning and divergent reasoning. And I got some other perfect scores on the Air Force tests. And I was supposed to be in RIA school, Radio Intercept Analysis School. So after finishing my basic training at Lackland, they put me in PATS status, which means waiting for a security clearance, me and two of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was supposed to be sent to San Angeles, Texas to go into the security work. And if my clearance hadn't come through, then they would have sent me to weather school. And the captain who was in charge of distributing the orders butched the orders. He was when my security clearance came through, he was supposed to give me the orders to go to RIA school. But instead, I was given the unclassified orders to go to weather observing school in Chanute. And I kept two copies on the advice of my drill sergeant and in basic training. And so after I'd been in Chanute for like, 2 months, and I wasn't getting paid. I went down to the place that pays you,
yeah.
and showed him my orders. And then a couple days later, the MPs came and dragged me, got me out of class, took me over to the Chanute Air Force Base Commander's office, stood me up in front of the Chanute Base Commander, and he said, "Airman Hall, if you have a copy of your orders showing that you're supposed to be on this base, then you are a happy man, and the captain who gave them to you is getting 5 years in the brig."
No way.
Yeah, but if you don't, then he's a happy man, and you are getting 5 years
yeah.
in the brig. He said, the people in the Pentagon say you are too valuable to be risked like this. I had two copies of my orders. I was happy to give him all the copies he wanted. And so then they sent me back and said, okay, so you're a weather observer. And then when you when you're in tech school, for your first assignment, you fill out a wish list. And my wish list was March Air Force Base, Los Angeles, a base in England, and a base in Germany.
Yeah.
And the sergeant who was handing them out said, "No, you're going to Nellis. That's what they've told me." And so when the orders came through, my orders came for Nellis. And they didn't care what I'd put on my wish list, I guess. So in late February, early March 1965, I was sent to Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada, outside Las Vegas, and of course I had two stripes, and I was still in on the job training, and you're not supposed to be sent TDY out to the ranges until you finish your on the job training, but in late April, I'd only been there on Nellis, just a few from 1st of March to late
right.
April. The base, as I describe in my first book, Millennial Hospitality, or parts of it, the base, my immediate commander, who was a major, when it was called over to the base commander's office at Nellis one day, and they said when the existing guy who was out on the ranges at Indian Springs, when he was coming up for a discharge in late April, early May, they said when the Pentagon had said, when you replace him, send Charlie. And the commander said, but, you know, Charlie hasn't finished his OJT yet. And the base commander says the Pentagon doesn't care.
They wanted you.
Yeah, and so in early May of 1965, the first part, even though I hadn't finished the OJT part, the major called me and said, you're going to Nellis, or you're going to the gunnery ranges to replace the guy who was there. And we'll just have to figure out some way to finish your OJT training. The Pentagon thinks you're ready, and that's how I ended up on the ranges for the first time.
And now tell me what happens at these gunnery ranges for people who aren't aware of this.
On paper, they're in 1965. On paper, they're supposed to be ordinary gunnery ranges where pilots practice bombing and strafing. So, because they support the fighter training
school. Right.
So, for example, when the ranges are in use, as say like Range 3, there's four ranges, and then there's some air-to-air ranges. But at Range 3 in 1965, a typical day might be for a group of, say, pilots, well, say like from Rhode Island one day, a group of six pilots, a colonel and five trainees, might fly into Nellis from Rhode Island on schedule, and then might be scheduled for 2 hours or 3 hours of practice to practice bombing and strafing the targets that are out in the desert, dropping skip bombs and strafing the tanks and strafing other targets and so on. And then there's a set of maintenance men, or there were a set of range maintenance men, who would man the tower, a range officer who would come up from Nellis and, run the control tower during the training practice. And then after the mission, they would go out and score the targets and tell the pilots how well they'd done. And in between runs, go out and pick up the bombs and do the maintenance work.
Now, Paula, when you began to investigate the story, honestly, how did you feel about it before you really started digging into it?
Well, when I read the books, I was appalled. The books are so detailed. I mean, nobody could possibly remember. I don't know if you were listening to Charlie, the dates. He's giving dates.
He's giving times.
No one could have this kind of detail without having lived it. I mean, no one could have imagined it. So when I read the books, already I had an idea this man might be telling the truth. I needed to do a lot of investigation because this story is so completely different from anything else that I've investigated. How did I feel when I began to digest the fact that Charles Hall actually met tall white aliens who had children? I mean, the fact that the children, the added element of children, families, it changed my whole reality. I mean, I had to really stop and think for a while, what is really happening? Are we really hosting people? And these are humanoid type aliens who resemble us greatly. What is the reality here? And then I had to remember another thing, George, that this was 1965, before we went on the moon, before we had all this media, before we had Close Encounters, the film, before any of this happened. We have a Charles Hall who's having an absolutely incredible experience, a traumatic experience, and then I have to try to understand what else is being hidden from us if this is really the truth.
When we come back from the break, Paula and Charles, we'll get right into this story at the Indian Springs Gunnery Range, what you saw, how you saw what you did. Paula, as you have looked at many UFO cases before, how would you categorize this one in terms of its excitement level and reliability level?
Well, he's got all his ducks in a row. I have his papers. The reliability is very great. The excitement level, it depends on how you view the whole UFO phenomenon. It's very exciting in that it's a story that will help us turn the corner in ufology to really look at this in another way and to realize that we need to do something about this kind of, visitation, this kind of hosting of these people or these peoples on the planet.
All right, when we come back, we'll be talking with Paula Harris. She's live in Italy. And, of course, Charles Hall. And we're going to get his story when we come right back. Charles Hall is our guest, along with investigative reporter Paula Harris. Charles has written a series of three books called the Millennial Hospitality Series. And you will very shortly find out why the title is what it is. Charles, let's go to you now as you're at Nellis Air Force Base. If you're at the gunnery there at Indian Springs in Nevada, what are some of the strange things? Now, when you first got there, it was normal, right? You didn't see anything unusual?
Well, before I went out there, my friends told me that the legend of Range 4 Harry and said that the legend of Range 4 Harry, as I describe in my book, was that presumably everyone you talked to had a different version of the legend, but the typical version was that they said there was this large white radioactive horse that would come out at night. It was fluorescent, and it would float around the gunnery ranges up by Range 4, which was north of Range 3. And even my commander, the major, had claimed to have seen it from a distance of perhaps three-quarters of a mile or a mile. And even when I went out there, and the other men who had been there had said there was something that was unusual about the ranges.
Now, did you see any unusual surveillance going on with this, or did it seem like whatever was out there, people who were regulars there, people who had been stationed there for a long time, really knew about this and it didn't bother them?
I don't know. I wouldn't say it didn't bother them, because the guy I was replacing had gone over the hill. And he, as I describe in my books, he had actually, at least 41 weather observers before me who had been stationed out there for temporary duty and varying lengths of times for the 7 years before I went out in 1965. And each of them had been compromised in some way. Most of them had become terrified and wouldn't go out in the ranges. They would just sit in the chow hall at Indian Springs and make up the winds and phone them in and pretend they were releasing the balloons. Others, some of the others had been burned. One, as I describe in my books, when I went for my routine medical checkup before going out on the ranges, one of the young ladies there who was my age, I was 20 at the time, showed me the x-rays and the pictures of one of the men before me, and his whole left arm from his shoulder to his elbow looked like it had been cooked in a microwave oven. And he'd been given a medical discharge, and in his medical records that he had clearly told the doctor that he had encountered Range 4 Harry, which he described as a radioactive horse, and his medical records clearly stated that it looked as though that the damage to his arm was similar to the damage from Hiroshima victims. And so I wouldn't say that going out there was ever normal or routine. As I describe in my books, when I was out there very early on, one of the maintenance men, when I was playing poker with my three of my friends who were range maintenance men, and I was real new. As I described in my books, one of my friends had gotten up and said to me, or had over the poker game, had said, "Charlie, what do you think UFOs are?" And I'd said, "Oh, I don't know. It was one of my hobbies ever since 1955, studying UFOs and that." But I said, "Oh, I don't know." I quoted Alan J. Hynek, and I said, "Gee, He thinks they're swamp gas or whatever, you know. And I remember my friend got up and in a very animated fashion. And at the time, I didn't think that that it was possible to make the deep space crossing from the nearby stars because of the distance.
Sure.
And my friend got up in a very animated fashion and he said, no, you're wrong, Charlie. They're up the valley. They're dug in on those mountains at the north end of the valley. You'll see them like the others. You're wrong, you know. And that was really, so those were very early events. And so I wouldn't say that it was ever routine.
Well, when he told you that, Charles, that you're going to see them eventually, I mean, did you believe him?
No, the only reason that I didn't break out laughing was because he was such a good friend, and there were only four of us out in the boonies, and, you know, man needs all the friends he can get.
Yeah, that's right. You don't need another enemy out there, right?
Yeah, and so I listened respectively, and I said to him, I said, well, have you ever seen one? And he said, yes, and all three of them claimed that they had seen the tall whites picnicking at the natural spring that is in the mountains, just a few miles northwest of the main base at Indian Springs.
Now, what do you mean by picnicking, Charles? I mean, like just having a family gathering?
Yeah. There's a spring, a natural. When you looked on the map on an ordinary road map of Nevada, from when you're right in the town of Indian Springs, just to the northwest, only a few miles out, like I'm going to say 5 miles or maybe closer, but in those mountains on the west side of the valley, they show a natural spring, which I guess now is part of the Desert Southwest Game Range, or now they have a state park up in there, which is restricted and nobody can go there. And he said that he and the other men were there, that they were there one day, not at the spring, but on the road leading up to it, and that the scout craft was parked next to the spring. It's kind of like a Garden of Eden place or a desert oasis.
Sure.
And he said that the tall whites were there, and they sleep in hammocks. And he said that they had the door of the scout craft open, and he said that when you came over the hill that you could see them there, just doing what people do when they picnic with their family. And he said that was the first time that he and a couple of the range maintenance men had seen them. And I didn't know what to do, and I said, well, if the door of the scout craft was open, what did you see when you looked inside? And he took out, he said there was a set of, there was a panel with a set of buttons, and making a long story short, and he said that he drew on the buttons there were icons. Now, in 1965, that was quite rare, but you know how now you buy a car and it has, like, a picture for the lights and a picture for the headlights?
Yeah, yeah.
And he said that's what was on the buttons. So, and I said, what did they look like? And he took out a piece of paper and he drew the top seven. And I used to have that piece of paper with me when I was at Indian Springs. I had it for, like, almost 2 years. I used to keep it in my wallet. The top button was looked like a little icon of the sun, and it controlled the outside lights. As I later found out, and I found out that his memory of the buttons had been perfectly correct. And they were just, the switches just did ordinary things, like open and close the door, turn on the outside lights, turn on the inside lights, and so on. But when he first did it for me, I took the piece of paper and I put it in my wallet, more out of respect for, you know, just to, so I had a friend,
uh-huh,
than because I believed it.
Okay.
And
George, can I add one thing?
Oh, absolutely. Jump in anytime, Paula.
I didn't add that when I was doing the investigation that Captain David Coote and I flew Charles to Indian Springs in June of 2004, and we were there for 3 days, and we filmed him. In fact, we made a CD of part of this, and we filmed him telling the story and walking and describing what he saw in the Indian Springs area. Now, we couldn't get on the base. I mean, you could see the base from where we were, the Indian Springs base, and the, you know, the military were there and so forth, but just outside the base, several things had gone on that Charles had described in the book, including there was a house, he said, where there was a human little girl that used to play with an alien little girl, and we wanted to go to those places that he described in the book, so we physically flew him there and spent 3 days there going over his story, because I wanted to be sure that what he was telling us was the truth.
Paula, let me ask you, too. I mean, this seems to be leading up to the fact that our government freely knew and acknowledged and probably supported and participated in these arrivals of these extraterrestrials. I mean, they weren't showing up unannounced, were they?
No, evidently Charles can tell you because he's better at it. It's kind of a way station where new people come, they come and go. Some people, since these people live to be 800 years old, some people have been here for 100, 200 years, and he can tell you about that. But what's truly amazing to me, and the listeners probably agree with this, is the fact that Charles is able to tell this story. I mean, the first thing that I said to him is, how come you can tell me this? How come we can talk about this? So as Charles continues his story, George, understand that this is part of disclosure for some reason.
Well, let's ask you this right now, Charles. Are you talking tonight on this program because you want to or because someone has asked you to in another government capacity?
No, I published the books and I was telling my story because I wished to. Nothing I did was ever classified. I was a weather observer, and weather information and weather observer activities are never classified. And I never went looking for them. They were happy to come looking for me. I was never part of any project that built things or designed things or, you know, built new vehicles or whatever. A weather observer is a guy that just goes out and looks at the clouds. And even during the Korean War, the North Koreans, the Red Chinese, and the Americans freely exchanged weather information on an hourly basis because weather information is considered so valuable. When I came off the ranges, meeting the extraterrestrials was an extremely emotional experience. I would estimate that in the times that I was out there, the 2 years that I was out there, I probably felt every emotion that, you know, I as a human can feel coming across them, from abject terror to, you know, laughter. I mean,
well, were your higher-ups aware that you knew what you knew when you were there?
If you went high enough up, yeah, but my immediate people didn't.
They did.
They didn't. But if you went high enough up, the Air Force, you know, the guys in the Pentagon, you know, I mean, they built the base. They knew. You'd see the generals out there with them, with the extraterrestrials on occasion, as I describe in my books. They'd come to my barracks at night. And incidentally, I agree with everything Paula said, and I really appreciate the help that Paul and David Coote have done. And so I want to say nice things about that.
Well, no, I understand.
I wanted very much to convey the emotion that I felt to my children and grandchildren, and that was my motivation for writing the books. It was kind of like being on the battlefield, you know, where you come off the battlefield with lots of emotions, and you find that you can't really use the spoken word to convey that emotion. But you know, you need to convey that. You want to convey that to, like, your kids and grandkids, what it was like to do that.
Did you meet the extraterrestrials or merely see them?
Oh, well, I met them many times, as I describe in my books. Although I never went looking for them. They were always happy to come looking for me.
Describe them. I know we have an animated picture of what they look like on the website. It's not the one you were talking about, Paula. But it gives people an idea. But those people who don't have the benefit of a computer, Charles, kind of describe the tall whites for us.
Well, the one that Paula has on her website is a very good rendition of a particular tall white lady. Each one of them are individuals, like the people, say, in New York City. But they were generally, throughout much of their adult life, they were about the same height as me, 5'11", 6 feet.
Mm-hmm.
They were very thin and frail. They had skin as white as a piece of paper, and they had less hair than a human. On the top of their head, they may only have had half as much hair. It was usually so white that it was transparent, and it was like, you know, like platinum blonde.
Almost like a person who is an albino?
Almost, yeah.
Okay.
They come from a planet. What I do know about them is that they come from a planet that's somewhat hotter than the Earth and somewhat larger than the Earth. And they naturally live underground. They don't naturally live in houses above ground.
Maybe that's the reason why their skin is so pale.
Yeah, their hearing is at least as good as that of a dog, and their eyesight is at least as good as that of a cat. But then as they get older, they grow again. When they get equivalent to a human, to a human 40 years old, and they live about 10 times as long as people, so when they get about roughly around 400 years old, they start growing again, eventually, but their organs don't keep up with the growth. The growth is just their outer skeleton and their muscles. So eventually they get very, very tall. Like the really old ones can be 8, 8.5, 9 feet tall, maybe even taller, because they'll get so tall that you almost can't, that I, when I would see them, almost couldn't believe that a human could, or that a human form could, you know, because they look, they're humanoid, you know, they have two arms, two legs.
Yeah, yeah.
And to get that tall, but as they get taller, they get more, they get frailer and frailer.
Almost like a praying mantis?
Oh.
That kind of a skinny look?
Actually, they flesh out more so that they look more like a larger human when they're, say, 500, 600 years old than they do when they're, say, equivalent to a human 10 or 12.
How do they communicate with you?
Their natural language, when talking between themselves, sounds like a series of dog barks or bird calls. Since they can hear sounds that a human can't hear, it's possible for them to just be standing beside each other and talking to each other using sounds that we can't hear.
All right.
And so it'll seem like they're telepathic, but really they're just talking. Maybe I shouldn't use the word easy because I don't know how easy it is for them, but many of them have learned to speak English, and so those who speak English could come up and talk to me in English.
Do they have voices that sound like ours when they speak English?
Oh yeah, their vocal cords are much more flexible than ours, and so it's perfectly possible for one. Say, like, it was perfectly possible for Range 4 Harry to call me on the telephone and sound like any person he thought I should be. That he wanted to. He could call up and sound like any one of my friends, and he had a very dry sense of humor. They don't sound robotic or anything. It takes them a while to learn to use contractions, and so when they first learned English, they'll speak so-called beautiful English, where they'll say, for example, we did not understand, you know.
Right.
But then they understand contractions because their hearing is so good. So if you said, I didn't mean that, they pick up the contraction. But later, when they get better at English, then they'll start using contractions. A few of them, like the teacher and Pamela, the tall white whose CIA name was Pamela, they got so good at English, and Range 4 Harry, that they got so good at English that they could even laugh in English. At first, when they've learned English, if you tell them a joke and they're laughing, they'll break down into their natural dog barks. And but then after a while, they'll realize that that's very terrifying for a human to be around a person barking like a dog.
Did they tell you, Charles, where they were from? What star system they might have come from?
No, they never came to tell me anything. They always came for their own purposes. And so almost everything I learned, I had to figure out for myself. They would answer a few questions, but like as I describe in my book, one night I was there with the teacher, and she was watching the children play. And they never come alone. They always come in groups with guards, and they always come well-armed. And they always came in military fashion, so, you know, they would never bunch up. They'd never bunch up. If they came, they'd deploy around you military style, you know. And so, and I was never armed. I never took a gun or anything out there. I was just a weather server. And I asked her where she came from, and she smiled and said, asked me, do I know the names of the stars that the tall whites use when they describe when they talk about the stars? And I said, no, I didn't. And she said, so if we told you, you still wouldn't know where we came from, right? And I said, that's right. And she said, so why do you want to know where we come from? And then they were all laughing because they'd outthought Charlie. You know, I guess it was so easy for them to outthink me. You know, then they all went around laughing. You know, we outthought him. However, one night they were standing around me, and I mentioned the star Arcturus, and they all got real nervous.
Really?
Yeah.
Why would they get nervous, even if you were right?
I'm not sure, but. But, you know, the star, I don't think Arcturus is their home planet, but I feel certain that it's one of the way stations that they stopped at to get here.
All right, when we come back, Charles, I want to talk more about these and also find out if there were any other species out there or just the tall whites. And, of course, our guest, Paula Harris, as well. She's live in Italy. And welcome back with Paula Harris and Charles Hall. Paula, before we go back to Charles, you said that with the help of an L.A. police officer, Natalie, you were able to find, a couple other people from Nellis?
Yes, one other in particular, the person that Charles called Little Jimmy Payne, who has another name, and we had looked. We had originally hired a private investigator to find this person, and David Coote and I didn't find him, and then we asked Steve to jump in. He's a great listener of yours, and in about a week found him, and we were able to call him and so forth and verify all the stories that, the poker stories and all the stories that Charles had said that he had, lived with these people on the base. And this man remembered him very well, remembered the legend of Range 4 Harry. But it occurred to us at the time that Charles was very special, that Charles was the only one that really could live through this experience, because the other people, as he mentioned, had trouble, and a lot of them, he said, a lot of weathermen before him, so that something was special about Charles's way of dealing with life, and he'll tell you his way of dealing with fear, where he was able to actually live with these people for a year and a half and come away with it to be able to talk about it. And I think that's the crux of this whole entire story. I'm beginning to believe anymore that some kind of accord was made by these people and the military not to hinder Charles in any way from telling this story.
Well, that may be true. Charles, you feel as if with the book, the Millennial Hospitality Series, and what you're saying tonight, that they would endorse you, they being in government right now? Or do you think they're back cringing, going, oh, no, Charles, don't say this?
I would think they would endorse me because my book is not confrontational. It doesn't criticize the government in any way or the tall whites. It doesn't advocate any change in policy, or it doesn't, say, gee, what should have been, what could have been. What I'm trying to do in the book is simply to capture the emotions that I felt and convey them to the reader. And I had to change the names of people and places in the book to protect the innocents, myself included. I had to change a few of the distances and directions in order to protect myself, and also, because it's not my intention to upset anyone. What I'm trying to do simply is to convey my emotions.
Are the stories fiction based on fact, or is it all true?
Everything in the book is fact.
Okay.
The only thing I changed was the names of the people in the place.
All right.
To protect the innocent.
Fair enough. Now, right before the top of the hour break, as we were leading into this hour, you were stumbling across almost where they might have been from, and you said they seemed a little shocked, dismayed. Why don't you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Sure. And I should also say that I'm very happy with the picture of the tall white lady that is on Paula Harris's website, because that matches. Paula and I worked communicated carefully on that. And that tall white lady stood about 6'2", and she was, and there was a very particular tall white lady that picture matches.
And Paula, that's the one made by Teresa Barbatelli?
Barbatelli here in Italy, but we had three artists working on this, George. I mean, we gave Charles at least, nine different drawings, and he couldn't say they all were perfect, so what we did, he said that the tall white lady that he calls the teacher looked like the model Twiggy. I don't know if you remember the model Twiggy in the 70s. He said she had big eyes. They have wraparound blue eyes, and she had a very thin body like the model Twiggy. So we started with that, and then we tried to get these Italian artists to work on it. But I think ultimately, and it'll debut on your website first,
it is up there right now, I think.
No, the composite from the...
No, not the composite, picture. Just the picture of Teresa that you gave us is up on the website.
Okay, now you're going to get a composite from a forensic artist from the Anaheim Police Department, thanks to Steve Natale.
Yeah.
For the first time ever, we've got cooperation from someone not on police time, but on her own private time.
I understand.
Who works as a forensics artist, and she's going to give you the actual face of the, according to Charles, really intricate description of the teacher.
I got to tell you, these tall whites, Paula and Charles, kind of look like the alien grays with a wig on. You know, they've got that kind, that eye shape and everything else.
They're definitely not grays. The grays are the ones that, you know, on which, who were related to the Roswell incident.
Yeah.
They're definitely not grays. You probably couldn't get a tall white and a gray in the same room without having one awful battle.
So there is friction there.
Oh, the big time, big time. They fight like cats and dogs.
Why is that?
I can only guess, but because as I say, no one ever came to me and explained anything. I had to just figure it out for myself.
Have they been warring, do you think?
I can only guess. I wouldn't think they were. I don't think they're fighting openly, but I can only guess. Answers to questions like that, I can only answer questions based on my personal experience, and I don't have any personal experiences in that area. But the tall whites, the tall whites were individuals just like humans, and both in shape and appearance, but also, or, you know, just like humans, but also in terms of personality too. So, the lady, for example. The whose pictures, you know, on Paula's website, or whose that we based the sketch on.
Yeah.
She was somewhat more nervous than most tall white women, but not unduly so, because she was perfectly willing to come with her guards and with three children that were with her.
Her guards being other tall whites or being military, U.S. military?
No, other tall white guards. When I was out at the ranges, usually the tall whites came with just tall whites. They only came with American generals.
Were they armed?
To the teeth, yeah. The adults were always armed. The children weren't. And when they got old enough, they weren't.
Why would they be walking around with weapons?
Because they know what humans are like, okay? Because once a human panics, they may have to protect themselves.
Okay, so they were fully aware that at any point they could be in jeopardy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. See, from their point of view, we're built like gorillas. We could fall down and break a leg, and then in a month, 6 weeks, we're up and running again. If they fell down and broke a leg, it took them like 5 years to heal up.
Of course, they lived 400 to 700 years, didn't they?
Yeah, and see, they're way frailer than we are. They never wanted to be touched by a human. They never came out to shake hands or to touch me or anything.
Not emotional?
Well, they're emotional like we are, but they're not. And between themselves, they certainly touch each other and stuff between themselves. But you know how, like, when I go to the zoo, I never want to touch a gorilla, and I doubt the gorilla ever wants to touch me.
Yeah, but you would pet a little monkey. You'd pet a puppy.
I never have pet a monkey. Okay.
All right, I have.
Yeah, you know, and they're like that. When they came out, they're not human, so they do see things, although they're very similar to us. They have all of our emotions and stuff. They treat the emotion of anger much differently than we do, but they don't come. When they would come, they wouldn't come and say hello. They wouldn't greet me when they came. They wouldn't say goodbye when they left. They came when they wanted. They left.
They just turned around and left, huh?
Yeah, and if they didn't have anything to say in between, especially the men,
they just stood there.
Yeah, so you really might. So many times I might be out there watching, you know, say taking my balloon readings, and three or four of them might step out from behind the Range 3 lounge and walk up and just stand, say, 10, 15 feet around and watching me.
What do they eat, Charles? What do they drink?
Well, they drink water and fluids just like we do. And if they don't get water and fluids, they die of thirst just like we do. They're plant eaters. They don't eat meat at all. They have no desire whatever for wool, clothing, or anything that has to do with animals. They're plant eaters. They don't have teeth. They have ridges instead of teeth. And the only food of theirs that I personally saw looked like mushroom pudding, which the teacher had prepared for the kids.
Of course, they devoured that.
Yeah, well, the teacher used to have this joke that she would tell about the three kids that she would typically bring with her. One was a little fat by their standards, but not fat by human standards.
Right.
Stouter. In my book, I call him the little fat astronaut. And the teacher used to have this dry joke. She used to say, he's the one that likes the food, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Implying that the other two used to...
I mean, were these kids good or were they brats?
The kids, all of the children, perfectly behave for their parents. The idea that the child would disobey the parents was just out of the question. The children were just perfectly obedient. And the other side of the coin is the parents would do anything for their kids. As you see in my book, in book two entitled The Night of the Fathers, the tall white fathers probably broke every rule you can imagine just to come out and make sure that it was okay with me and also okay with them. If the children came and played where I was.
In your opinion, Charles,
they would do anything for the kids.
What were they doing here?
Well, they were doing the same thing here that the U.S. Air Force or the U.S. Navy does with any military base. They were running a military base where the deep spacecraft would come on schedule, put in for repairs and refueling and refurbishing, and then stand out to deep space again. They were literally running an airport. You know, what it is what they're doing in the mountain is the same thing that happens at any airport. You know, and if you knew the airline schedule, you could tell which deep space was coming, how long it would be important, when it would be.
And we freely let them come and go. Why?
The U.S. Air Force would do anything for technology transfer.
And you believe there has been?
Well, I'm quite certain of it, although... the tall whites. The tall whites are easy to negotiate with, but there has to be something in it for them. You know, like when you sat down and negotiated with them. You know, like one of the first deals I negotiated with them after it took me more than 6 months to get over the terror, and to get over the denial, and to get over all the emotion,
mm-hmm.
to where I was willing to...
Of thinking about life elsewhere, things like that?
Yeah, for the first 6 months, as I describe in my book, I went through a lot of nights of white terror and stuff. And one of the first agreements I negotiated with them was that if I saw one of them out in the desert, or, you know, out at the Range 3 Lounge, that I wouldn't come up behind them and scare them.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
in return, they wouldn't come up behind me and scare me. And that if I saw them, I would just stand where I was and let them approach me as closely as they felt comfortable. And if they felt like turning and going away, I would never pursue. I would just stand there and let them go away. And vice versa. If they were coming up to me and they got too close so that I felt uncomfortable, that I would back away and they wouldn't pursue. They would let me back away until I felt comfortable. And they were quite happy to agree to that, but on the other side of the coin is they're sort of like Philadelphia lawyers. Once you make an agreement with them, they expect the human to observe the agreement
mm-hmm.
to the letter, just as they themselves intend to observe the agreement to the letter. And so when you do make an agreement with them, you have to be careful to make sure that you've done everything you can to do that, see? And that worked quite well, because that would allow... Because, see, they're naturally as afraid of us, or more so than we are of them. And so, see, new arrivals might be too afraid to even be seen, to even step out from behind the lounge and let you see them. And see, only the experienced troops were willing to walk up to me and say, like, come within 5 or 10 feet of me and say hi.
How many were there?
Oh, one night, as I describe in book three, in the chapter entitled The End of Innocence, one night I saw more than somewhere between 200 and 300 of them lined up along the mountain to the east, and I couldn't count them all. I stopped counting at
a whole colony for crying.
Yeah, and they had more than 30, somewhere between 35 and 70 scout craft out there in the desert. I couldn't count them all because their parks were closed.
And what did the craft look like from the outside?
Oh, and they had the American generals with them on that night, by the way.
So they're obviously part of this. What the craft? Oval shaped, like we've been told. Triangular. What does it look like?
The craft are white and ellipsoidal. Now they have two kinds. They have the deep space craft.
Bigger ones?
The much larger, and they are titanium black, and they are like ellipsoidal. And then they have the scout craft, which are built here on the Earth. The scout craft are white and ellipsoidal, and they're like sort of like a flying RV, or you know, sort of the size of a diesel truck with a double trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And the scout craft come in different sizes because they build them here, and they use parts supplied by the American Air Force. But the tall whites keep the anti-gravity propulsion system, that technology, in their hands. They haven't shared that with the Americans.
Are we trying to sneak it?
I have no idea, but...
George, can I say something about
this?
Yes,
you
may. Because as we're listening to this, which is, again, I have to remind the listeners, we're in 1965, and Charles just said they were built on Earth. We have the scout craft built on Earth, so is it possible, and I just wrote a piece that I put on my website about this, is it possible that some of the UFO sightings that we're seeing are these scout craft that were built here, and we can't tell the difference between our technology and their technology anymore? I mean, what are we seeing? Are we seeing real UFOs, or are we seeing technology that goes back as far as 1965? So for me, this presents a lot of ethical questions, a lot of, you know, the more I study this, the more questions come up about this particular thing.
But no doubt in your mind, Charles, that we are in cahoots with their visitation.
Oh, no question. After you saw the generals and the tall and their tall white counterparts, they would come through my barracks at night. I mean, you know, when I say I saw the American generals with the tall whites, I mean they were like, you know, from one end of my bunk to the other.
You Did know? You ever see an argument between a tall white and a human?
Arguing with a tall white is a very dangerous undertaking. They don't handle anger the way we do.
Will they just kill you?
Or go away. If you're lucky, they'll just go away and won't deal with you. If you, if the tall white says, as I describe in book three, or book two and book one all over the place, if you're with a tall white and like if you're walking up towards one and he says the word no, stop there, he means exactly no, stop there.
What if you don't?
He'll kill you if he has to. If he has to, he will. Okay? When they say the word no, they mean exactly no. Right now, no. They seldom use the word no, but when they do use it, you know, they mean it exactly. And so when you're arguing with it, so I never saw a general argue with the tall white.
How would they kill you? With their super ray gun or what?
Oh, they had the set of weapons that worked on microwaves, and they all had them up like the sleeves on their clothing and stuff, and it was adjustable, and you could adjust it to stimulate the atoms of sodium or calcium or iodine. If they the typical one where they adjust it to sodium, if they fired it at you, it was kind of like touching a high voltage power line.
All right, this was 1965. Here we are now, 2005. Are they still out there?
They have to be. The base that they dug in, the base they had up in the mountains, had a perfect location from the point of view of a deep spacecraft. And I mean, the U.S. Air Force had poured a lot of concrete on that place. And I wouldn't think the tall whites would idly have wanted to move it.
Do you think by now we've picked up on their propulsion system? 38, 39 years from now.
I can only guess, because the tall whites, they did not want to share the anti-grav drive, the various aspects of it with it. I have a theory called Hall photon theory, which I describe in book three, and which I describe what I believe is the physics of how they work, and it starts from known American physical experiments in the field of physics, because, as you know, I have a master's degree in physics. Things like the Michelson-Morley experiment and so on, and the water-filled telescope and the toroidal coil, and in which I describe how those should be analyzed.
Let's talk about that when we come back, Charles, and you as well, Paula. I'm going to ask you a few more questions about your investigation. I'm George Norrie with this fascinating story on Coast to Coast AM. Paula, with this story that happened 40 years ago, did you have any obstacles investigating the story?
No, and that's what's so strange about this, because this is the first thing I, you know, asked myself when I went with Captain David Coote to interview Charles. The first thing I thought when we walked out of his house said, how come we can talk about this? We looked at each other and said, how come this is okay. How come now in 2003, 2004, it is, you know, something that we can, is someone directing this disclosure? And George, I wanted to add that I am flying to the 14th Annual International UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, and we'll be there with Charles on March 6th through 12th, so people can talk to him in person, and also at the X Conference in Washington, D.C., April 21st through 24th this year. So Charles will be there both times with me at these places, which means he'll be speaking in public.
Charles, was there ever a time that you wanted to take pictures of the tall whites?
No, and the reason is because, remember, they came through my barracks at night, along with the American generals. And when you're actually out there with them, you know, your mind isn't. It's a very emotional experience. Your mind isn't on that at all. Your mind is on keeping yourself. At least in my case, my mind was on keeping myself alive. You know, once you realize that they were real and what the kind of technology they had and so on. You'd never want to. I mean, I'm out there by myself, alone in the desert. If anything goes wrong, you know, I'm the one at risk. I took myself out there. I got to bring myself back.
Did you feel threatened at all?
Each one is individuals, and so how threatened a person felt depended entirely on who was present. One of their tall white generals. I didn't feel like he meant to do me harm, but on the other hand, he was a general. If he said stop there, he meant.
They were all business, weren't they?
Yeah. On the other hand, there were others, like the tall white, who used the CIA names, the school bus driver and the mechanic. They almost seemed like brothers. And Range 4 and I, you know, Range 4 Harry and I, there's an actual tall white guard named that, communications officer. You know, he and I became, when he came around, it felt like you were talking to a brother or a first cousin. So how comfortable or how threatened you felt depended on who you were talking to. But even when you knew them, there was a great deal of tension or stress when they came around because they aren't human, and they don't handle anger the way we do. And until they got to know humans very well, you know, you always had to be very careful. You never wanted to make them angry.
Can you be a little more specific for us on where you think they might originate?
My best guess, and it was purely a guess on my part, is a star that's 105 light years away, but I don't know which one. I also wanted to say how much I appreciate the help from Paula Harris and David Coote. And Paula's book, Connecting the Dots, you know, was a really interesting book. And I wanted to say thanks for them as well and how much I've enjoyed, you know, working with them.
Okay, but so you think that they're out 100-plus light years away.
Yeah, that's just a guess on my part. I know that when I was talking with the teacher and she was talking about the tall white lady next to her, whose CIA name was Pamela. I remember the teacher stated that Pamela had actually never been back to the home planet, and that one of the trips that Pamela was looking forward to, that they were going to take, was actually taking her back to visit the home planet.
Did they ever describe their planet, what it looked like, what their buildings looked like? I know you said they live underground, but I'm sure they have structures down there.
There were a few things about their home planet that I was able to reason out based on, you know, by studying them, but there were lots of things that I was not able to reason out. Now, their underground living area, which is also in the mountains, their main base has two parts. It has the hangar and the base and the place where they deal with the spacecraft.
You're talking about here now, on this planet.
Yeah. Then there are living areas on the mountain peak next to it, and it's all underground in tunnels. I never went down in the tunnels. I never had that kind of guts. I'm not that brave, but I have no idea what it's like underground, and I'm not a very brave person. I never want to see what's underground.
It sounds to me, Charles, that in spite of meeting them, you didn't trust them for some reason, because I'm picking up a fear factor here in terms of things, and you're right. I mean, it would be jarring to know there was an extraterrestrial. It is pretty awe-stricken when you hear something like that. But it's
sort of like being in New York City. There's people in New York City that you could trust with your life. There's, you know, priests and firemen there that you could be burning, and they would come and do everything they could to keep you alive. On the other hand, I'm sure there must be people in New York City that, you know, that I wouldn't want to be out on the dock at 10 o'clock at night and carrying $10, you know?
True.
And the tall whites are like that. They're proudly individualistic. And so there were people like the teacher where, you know, you could trust with your life, and Range 4 Harry and stuff, that if, you know, as long as you didn't do anything silly, you were never at risk. On the other hand, there were other people, like the captain, who were kind of in between. You didn't have to worry when he was around, but on the other hand, he didn't really understand humans very well, and he didn't really want to. He just wanted to come and do his business and leave.
Did you ever see any violence from them?
They never attacked me if they weren't provoked or terrified. They never came just to be cruel or how humans might go and say whip a dog just to see what happens. They weren't like that at all. They were plant eaters, and they believed in tit for tat. If you didn't harm them, they wouldn't harm you. If you didn't,
George, you know, I wanted to add one thing that's really interesting about these aliens, these people, that they were allowed to go off the base, and you might want to, pursue this, to go into Las Vegas. And can you imagine a civilization that thinks that we are made of Las Vegas?
Well, yeah.
Gives new meaning to the number 7, you know.
Yeah, the thing that's really interesting is, and Charles talks about this in his book, he, a couple of times when he was on leave and when he was, you know, they had R&R, and this was Las Vegas in 1965, not Las Vegas in 2005, but he actually saw them accompanied by, he said, intelligence people, and they were wearing wigs and dark glasses. Maybe Charles would like to talk about that, because it might be interesting. These aliens did get to go off the base a couple of times in Las Vegas.
Hi, I thought I saw some of them a few months ago there.
Yes, they came to a lot. The ones that were used to being around humans, the ones that were the same height we are, or not too tall, they quite routinely would come into Las Vegas, especially at night. Because remember, the tall whites, they love to travel around at night. They know that their eyesight is way better than ours, and their hearing is way better than ours.
What do they do in Las Vegas?
What every tourist does, because they get bored out in the desert, just like you and I would.
Don't tell me they play blackjack.
Well, I've seen them play blackjack, yeah, described in my books, yeah. Because their eyesight is better than ours, for them it's not even a game. They always know what the next card is.
I assume we give them the cash to play, huh?
That's my belief, yeah. One of the places they used to like in the 60s was the casino, the Stardust. The Stardust in the 60s used to have a motif that was like, you know, like being out in the galaxy in space.
They love that.
They used to love that. And they that used to be one of their favorite places.
Sounds like a Star Trek bar, or Star Wars bar.
Yeah, remember? And when you looked up at the ceiling, it would be our rendition of what it would look like if you were out in space looking at the galaxy. And they used to love to come through at night and, you know, and see that, especially at night. And they used to love to walk around the desert at night and look at the stars, because that is something they couldn't do on their home planet, because their atmosphere is much thicker than ours.
True, good point.
But that stretch down by the Stardust on the Strip in the 60s, it was very common to see them down in there.
Would you look twice at them if you saw them walking down the street? I mean, like you said, they're whitish and...
Well, they would disguise themselves.
They look like they're from some rock band or something.
They would disguise themselves to look like humans. And remember, you know, having been in Las Vegas, you know, for station in Las Vegas, you know, when you walk around Las Vegas, you'd see all kinds of humans. You know, people from India, China, rich people from Saudi Arabia. You know, you'd see showgirls and people who were members of bands that were, you know, dressed up.
You'd see people who didn't even look human.
Yeah, and, you know, and they would just be actors and actresses. But I remember I was there when they were filming, when they were filming some of the scenes from Diamonds Are Forever, so you could see actors and actresses and all sorts of stuntmen all made up to look unusual. And, of course, at 2 in the morning in Las Vegas, you see lots of guys that are just sobering up. So, you know, when you walked around Las Vegas, it wasn't at all unusual to have somebody who seemed a little unusual next to you or, you know, in the same casino next to you. And you just figure, oh, I guess they came from somewhere that I hadn't been. And if you actually asked the tall whites where they came from, they loved to pretend they were from northern Spain. You know, if you actually pressed them, they'd say they were here on a trade mission from northern Spain.
How long have they been coming here? Now, you saw them in 65, but, I mean, have they been coming here for hundreds and hundreds of years?
Well, in the logbooks in my weather station, I was able to, you know, the logbooks went back 7 years, and the legend of Range 4 Harry, I was able to trace that back to 1954. But I note that the ancient Greeks, in the Greek myths going back to like 900 or 1000 BC, the Greek myths called the star Arcturus the Watcher. And the Greek myths, according to Greek myths, from 1000 BC, a group of tall white gods came to Earth from the Watcher star. And then when the men of ancient Greece were out camping at night in the summertime, these gods would come and stand out beyond the ring of the firelight and just watch them. And so it wouldn't surprise me if the tall whites hadn't been coming here off and on since at least 1000 B.C.
They talk about how they got here in terms of their propulsion, that they come through wormholes. I mean, how were they able to do this?
I never saw any evidence of wormholes or anything like that. Their deep spacecraft could clearly travel faster than the speed of light. And Range 4 Harry, when I was talking with him about on the scout craft, confirmed that the technology used in the scout craft was capable of propelling the scout craft faster than the speed of light, but he felt the scout craft wasn't built very well, and he was quite adamant that nobody in their right mind would take it anywhere near that fast. And although the deep spacecraft clearly made the journey by accelerating beyond the speed many times the speed of light.
You mentioned that Einstein's theories fell short a little bit. Elaborate on that for us, Charles.
Well, as I describe in Hall photon theory, I feel that there are more fields in the world of physics, like the electric field, the magnetic field, and so on, the gravity field. I feel that there's another field, one or more fields that have as yet been unrecognized. And I feel that within a photon that there has to be a third field as part of the physical structure of a photon. Currently, we're told that there's only two fields in a photon, an electric field and a magnetic field. But I feel there's a third one in there, and I feel that if you look at classic experiments like the Michelson-Morley experiment and the Waterfield telescope and so on, that you see this third field at work, that it explains why light sometimes behaves as a particle and sometimes behaves as a wave, that it's really the third field that's doing that. And that you can generate this third field using a toroidal coil, which is an electromagnet that looks like a donut. And I believe that, see, when you looked at their scout craft had a double hull construction, and their deep spacecraft also had a double hull construction. And then in between those two hulls, there was like 1,000 miles of fiber optic windings. And then what they would do is they would generate, and it was built sort of like a giant toroidal coil or magnetic, there were different sets of windings. One set of windings served to streamline the craft and protect the occupants from the forces of acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, it was common for the scout craft, if they powered it up fully, when you saw it out in the desert, it would first, when it was sitting there, it would first look like a craft. You know, you'd actually see the edges and the metal and the
walls. Right.
But then when they powered it up, it would take on a, when they powered up those windings, it would take the field. A field would be generated around the craft, and it would take on a fuzzy white appearance. Obviously offering them radiation protection if they're out in space.
Almost like a force field.
Yeah, and once it became fuzzy white, you couldn't actually see the windows anymore. You know, if you were at a safe distance. You know, like one day at a mile and a quarter, when I saw the scout craft landing with that field on it, the field coming from that craft stopped the engine on my truck. It made it seem like nothing electrical.
Well, and we've heard of those things around UFO cases. Yeah.
And once they powered up, they could move a distance of like 7 miles at an average speed of 8,000 miles an hour. They could lift up. And they could just go pop like 8,000 miles an hour and just stop.
Do you believe that people who have witnessed UFO sightings, Charles, might have been seeing some of theirs?
Might have, yeah. And see, the people on board weren't strapped in or anything. They were just sitting in a seat like you and I sit in our living room chair.
And they were fine because of that force.
Yeah, and see, if you were to try to do that with rockets, say like on a remote control craft, the forces of acceleration and deceleration would liquefy steel. You know, it wouldn't just turn people into ketchup and everything organic into mush. It would liquefy steel. But the people on board, you know, it didn't even move paper around, you know. I mean, you just sat there like you were sitting in your living room. And see, that takes more physics than what Einstein knew about. And see, when you look at, like, Alan J. Hynek's Project Blue Book findings, where he had those samples of stuff that dropped off from flying saucers, he described them like in 1968 as looking like the slag from an aluminum furnace, well, that had been heated to 1100 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, that's fiber optics. If you go and take fiber optics and you melt it, you heat it to 1100 degrees Fahrenheit, it's like 49%. Fiber optics are typically like 49% aluminum, and what you'll get is looks just like the slag from an aluminum furnace. The tall whites were very touchy about the heat on those coils. Lots of times you'd see them sit down at the scout craft, and when they got out, the first thing they would do is open up the panels on the back to let the coils cool off.
Hmm.
The deep spacecraft were designed so that everything, including the coils, was completely accessible from the inside. But the scout craft required that you go outside the craft to access those coils.
Did you ever see a craft break down or collide with another one?
In my books, in the chapter entitled Two Games and One Board, I described the day I watched the day in 1966 that I saw the coils on the one of the scout craft overheat and melt, and they worked from like Wednesday afternoon until Monday morning. The tall whites only, no humans. On those coils, several hundred feet before they wouldn't let me get any closer.
All right, stay with us, Charles Hall, Paula Harris. Phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with our guest Charles Hall, Paula Harris. Paula, at what point did you believe the story? From the get-go, or did it take a while?
Well, the way I operate, I'm as skeptical as I can be until I actually take the person to the place, or I actually spend a lot of time with the person. I've never done a story where I haven't been with the person for long periods of time. So I think when I actually believed the story is when we flew Charles to Indian Springs, and David Coote and I filmed him as he was telling us, and ironically enough, you had just asked about some kind of accident or if there was a collision. He was telling us about an incident and showed us and walked the path of where he had, you know, how this had happened, and walked over the sagebrush over to a telephone pole and described it of how there had been an accident where one of the spacecraft had a hole in it and there were children and women aboard, and how they had this relief on their face when they finally did land and so forth, and he told it in detail. That was one incident when we were in Indian Springs, and then the other incident, there is, if you read Millennial Hospitality, at night they used to go to the home of the teacher with the children, used to go to a home where there was a little human girl that used to come out and play with the alien children at night without her parents knowing about it. She'd come out the window and play with them. And that, to me, sociologically, because I'm interested in the exopolitics of this and the sociological aspect more than the technology of this, was very interesting. I wanted Charles to show me where the house was. I wanted him to tell me all this. And he was able to come through. He was able to actually give us details because we were on the spot.
Why did they bring children here, Charles?
The Travelers family groups, you know, they'd do anything for their kids. Their kids would do anything for the parents. The idea of being separated from their children is like, oh, unthinkable for them. Everywhere they go, they're willing to take their kids.
All right, we're going to take phone calls now this hour for you, Paula, and for you, Charles. So let's go right to the phones. Charles, I'm going to ask you to speak up as much as you can because you and Paula are now sharing a phone bank here. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George and Marie. Happy New Year to you and Paula and Charles. I have two questions, please. One is there were references in old magazine and newspaper articles, and apparently the bones of these tall whites are in the basement of the Smithsonian Institute. Washington, D.C., and I was wondering, Charles, if you thought those might be the same people? They were found in the Grand Canyon, and Indians talk about these people.
I can only talk from my direct experiences, and I don't have any direct experience that would let me make a statement about the bones.
Okay, so, I understand that.
Yeah,
and I like the friendly title you chose, but also, the person who took you was a pilot, and the name was Coot?
Yes.
And I do believe that I know this family.
Do you mean the pilot? The pilot and the family, you mean?
Yes.
So the pilot works with me. His name is David Coot. He flies for a commercial airlines, and he basically came. I asked him to come on board because I needed someone to do this story who was, a responsible, ethical person who could determine credibility and so forth. So maybe you would know David Coot. He currently flies for a commercial airline.
What does David say about this whole case, Paula?
Well, it'd be interesting for you to interview him. He at first was extremely skeptical. I mean, this is an incredible story, but he spent so much time with Charles, and even on his own has flown down to be with Charles in Albuquerque, that he is convinced that Charles believes he's telling the truth. That's the only way we could put it. That Charles believes that all the details he's telling are true, and that this needs to be looked at.
Doesn't Michael Sala believe this, too?
Yes, Michael Sala believes this. Actually, anybody who spent a long time with Charles knows that this is so rich in details. It's so rich in history. I mean, he knows what happened when. He can tell about the various incidents in Indian Springs. He remembers everything about when he was there. Also, his experience in the Vietnam War, that this is a tremendously credible...
Well, Paula, I want you to know David Coot is on the phone now.
Oh.
We're going to get him on right now, okay?
Okay.
I believe this is him. You can tell us if this is him or not, Paula. Hello?
G'day, Paula. How you doing?
David, wonderful. David is from New Zealand. He's got a New Zealand accent. He has also been in the military, so maybe, David, you can talk a little bit about the investigation.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks so much. And, George, thanks for taking my call. And, Charlie, how are you doing?
Hi, David. It's great talking with you and Paula tonight. I want to let you talk,
Sure. Well,
it's really great talking with you.
Thank you both for your kind words, and it's definitely my privilege to have an opportunity to be involved in this amazing story.
What did you think about it, David, when you were first brought into it?
Well, I never took UFOs seriously for a very long time, even though a chief pilot of mine had a sighting in a major incident in New Zealand in 78, 79, tracked on radar, lots of ground witnesses, and the U.S. Navy came in and did a big report on it. That was one thing that got my attention. The other thing that got my attention was my history. I was involved in a POW MIA cause for a while, and I came to find out about a gentleman named Colonel Corso who had testified at some Senate hearings on POWs left behind. And So when the book The Day After Roswell came out, I was kind of stunned to find out it was the same gentleman.
The
head of the Foreign Technology Desk and Eisenhower's intelligence officer. So he was credible in my eyes. So all of a sudden the UFO subject became pertinent and prominent. And having found out that, yes, we had left POWs behind, and even in the Vietnam War, we were not told the truth over many of these things, I decided I had to do some probing and find out exactly what else haven't we been told. And so the UFO subject, the more you dig, the more you find, and inevitably you come to this extraterrestrial subject. So I don't see why it's such an amazing thing anymore, because you look out in the universe, it's a huge universe. We are here. Why should they not be here? And in fact, we may even be related. I love to hear this story because Charles' story is not a Hollywood story. This is not something about grizzly or ghouly alien-type creatures that with monsters jumping out of their stomachs and drooling and wanting to eat people. this is about people like you and me that have kids, that love, that live, that have technology that's a little further down the track than ours. But it's an amazing story, and I think it's time for the truth. And this story may be the thing, the crack in the dam, the chink in the armor that brings the truth forth. And, of course, we have to be very wary and very aware that there are different factions and factors to this story. There are those who want disclosure, those who don't, those who perhaps feel they can use information for their own control purposes and power purposes. But basically, let us judge by their fruits, as the Bible says, and give them the benefit of the doubt until they prove themselves otherwise.
David, do you find yourself watching the skies a little differently now that you believe in this?
You know, I am always trying to be logical in my way of life, and you have to be pragmatic. After all, we have to go to work in the morning, and Charles has to try and catch some sleep before he gets to work again. And he's the one that's lived with these extraterrestrials. He's the one that's interacted. He knows the protocol now, and this is a very important lesson for mankind. We need to learn about not only the exopolitical, the protocol, but the exobiology, and even the exotheology. We need to know that we all have one God. It's got to be a unifying process, not a divisive process. And there are those that would like to perhaps divide and conquer. And this is not what we're about. All we're about is the truth. And whether this story is able to be proven or not, all we want is the truth. And it's a very, very hard story to prove because of the highly secure area these things took place in. And we're dealing with the military-industrial complex again once. As Eisenhower warned us to be aware and wary of, and just like Von Braun warned us to be wary of, these people need money to keep their industries running. So don't necessarily buy a threat. As Paula said earlier, we don't know what we're seeing in the sky, if it's our technology or extraterrestrial technology. Yes, I look in the skies a lot. I've never had a sighting. Actually, I have to take that back. Earlier this month, I saw something flying up the interstate here that I can't explain. It was a totally bizarre object, and very curious. I don't know what it is, but yes, I do watch the skies. George, thanks for asking.
Do most of your pilot colleagues believe, or are they skeptics?
No, I think most pilots are very much mechanically minded, logical. If you can't hold it, it doesn't exist. There is a small slice of the population of pilots that are a little bit more that way inclined, I guess. They are open-minded to it. But generalization, I would say that most pilots pretty much don't spend a lot of time thinking about UFOs and extraterrestrials.
I got to ask you one last question. It's a plane-related question, David, the flight question, and I'll go back to Charles and Paula and let you go.
I don't want to waste their time because they're important.
Very quickly, FAA is going to change the distance between planes from 2,000 feet to 1,000. What do you think about that?
Well, they actually have done that already. The first day they put that into practice was on the 20th of this month, and I was flying that day. I think it's quite okay. The barometric pressures at high altitudes, initially they thought it was going to be a factor as far as separation between the opposing traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've got it down now. We're under radar and we have GPS where the accuracy is safe now. And so they wouldn't institute these things until they'd proven that it was going to be safe for the public. And it's wonderful to see a big 747 go by either below you or above you at 1,000 feet with your closure rate.
Easy for you to say. All right, thanks, David.
Well, thank you so much, and all the best, guys.
Okay, very good. That was nice of him to call in like that, Paula. And Charles, let's go back to the phones. Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah, hi. Where are you calling from, sir?
I am calling from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Sure,
I'm sitting on the historic Summit Avenue in, I guess, the inner city of St. Paul.
Yes, you are.
First of all, David was a great help. I think my question ties in a little bit. I was worried that being on hold, I wasn't going to, the point was going to be missed. But Charles, and I'm sorry, the other guest you have, I tuned in late.
Paula Harris is here.
Paula's with us.
Paula.
And Charles.
Paula.
We're
great.
Good friends, yeah.
Okay, Paula. Charles, earlier you mentioned that the tall whites had a personality of their own. In a way, they were a little bit unpredictable and maybe rebels in their own right. And I was wondering, since you said that they were escorted into Las Vegas, they obviously have an interest in what's going on in this world. Have you ever heard of any of these tall whites, I guess maybe taken off on their own into the world? And not just the tall whites, but maybe any other civilization that might be studying us or interacting with us, that they may actually take off into our culture and try to learn our culture on their own instead of being escorted by us, and especially by their own culture, just like we have rebels in our own culture. Maybe they do as well.
They weren't necessarily escorted by humans when they came in. They'd come in with their own guards, and they may or may not come in with humans. One night when I was standing on the corner in downtown Las Vegas and out in front of the casino known as the Four Queens, when they came in fully escorted, they came in with a group of CIA guards. There were six of them, four men and two women, who first came in, spread wide, and took up positions around the, like a half block down from the intersection. And then the tall white guards came in, disguised as human, and took up their positions. And then the teacher and Pamela came in. And that's when they came in, like, fully escorted. On the other hand, on a different night, I saw just two of the young men, tall white men, walking by themselves down on the strip, heading down towards the Aladdin. And it was common to see them down by the Tropicana as well, just on their own. And some of the casinos, the CIA or the government had human guards who wouldn't necessarily walk around with the tall whites, but would just be like dealing. They'd be like blackjack dealers and pit bosses. And then they would, in effect, maintain safe casinos. So like the Stardust, sometimes the dealers, or in the casinos down by the Stardust, sometimes when you'd be walking through there, some of the dealers would just be, wouldn't be the usual union dealers. They would be like the government, like the CIA guards or the government guards who would come in and be just working the tables, with the knowledge of the security people in the casino. So that when the tall whites came through, there'd always be a few friends around, So like if you were to go up to one of the tall whites and say start asking too many questions, what you might find is the human guards would come and elbow you out of the way, And of course in history you also have the legend of Saint Germain back. I'm not sure the year, so I don't want to quote it. But remember, Saint Germain was described as having a chalk-white skin, only eating plants. Some people say that he was never seen to eat in public and seemed to know an awful lot about faraway places.
Well, Charles, let me ask you, do you think we possibly were seeded by these extraterrestrials thousands of years ago? Might they have been the ones to help jumpstart our civilization?
I don't think so, because
We're going to have to call you back, Charles, and get a better line. We'll do that with you right now. Paula, what do you think about that question? Might they have seeded us?
Should I hang up?
Oh, we got you. Now we have you. Where's Paula?
Then maybe it's Paula. You have to call back.
Maybe it is Paula.
Yeah, because I can hear you fine.
Paula, you there?
Yeah.
There you go. Okay. All right. Well, good. We'll go with that question then, Charles. Very quickly, do you think they seeded us?
I never saw, when I talked with them, I never saw any evidence that would support the statement. So in order for me to say anything, I'd have to guess. I personally don't think they did. I think they just came here. They weren't that interested in controlling us or anything like that. Anytime they did something, it was for their purposes, and they were very happy to be the way they were. And they weren't interested in... I never personally saw any evidence that they cared, you know, whether we fought with each other or what we did. So from my point of view, I don't believe that anyone treated us up. But, you know, I have to guess.
Well, we're having a bad line with you, so we're going to call you back. And are you there now, Charles?
No, I'm here now.
Okay, there you are, a little better. You can't share a line with Paula for some reason.
Want me to hang up?
No, you're okay where you are right now. Oh. It's just bad feedback put you on the same line with Paula. So we'll be right back. We'll finish up with more questions. Charles Hall, Paula Harris on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. It'll be our final segment now with our investigator, Paula Harris, who's live in Rome, and Charles Hall. Charles, how did you get the name Millennial Hospitality Series? How'd that come about?
Well, my wife and I picked it out. When I first tried to explain to my wife, back in the 1970s, after we'd been married 6 months, you know, about aliens and stuff, she had said that what she cared about was how she should act if we ever met one, that led to picking our name, Millennial Hospitality. And let me say, I really appreciate your music. They bring back so many memories, you know. especially that song, Get It On. Boy, it makes me feel young again.
It sure does. Well, in 1965, you were probably pretty young then, too, weren't you?
Yeah, I was still very young. And also, it was common for some of the men who were with me, and myself included on a couple occasions, when you first saw the tall whites, to mistake them for being ghosts. And so I've always felt that if a person looked at some of the so-called ghost stories or haunting stories carefully, that what the person was really seeing, sometimes they would be seeing ghosts, but sometimes they would also be seeing, they would have also just be seeing tall whites. I note that Harry Truman in the late 40s thought the White House was haunted, and he claimed that he'd seen the ghost of Abraham Lincoln. But when you go through his story carefully, I myself suspect that really it was the tall whites making contact with Harry Truman, because Harry Truman described the tall white, what he saw, as tall and white, a little bit taller than him. And he said when he went out into the hallway, that the guard in the White House had apparently fallen asleep standing up, or you'll allow me to say the word, hypnotized.
Yes.
And so I've always felt that by studying ghost stories, like here in New Mexico, the ghost of Dona Anacani, that what you were really looking at, which goes back to the 1600s, was observed by the Spanish and the Indians and so on, that what you were really looking at was people who were seeing the tall whites.
Ah, interesting indeed. All right, back to the phones we go. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, this is Steven,
mm-hmm.
calling from San Diego.
Hi, Steven.
Yeah, I just have a question for your guest.
Go ahead, Steven.
Yeah, okay. Basically, he was saying how they have guns. And I remember on a previous show that you've had that extraterrestrials come down here on Earth to, you know, they're peaceful, you know, they're anti-guns and stuff. So I was just wondering if your guest had an answer for me. Why do they carry guns, you know, along the lines of protecting themselves? Or what is it with that?
What was their main concern? And you can listen on the radio. What was your main concern there, Charles, with them having the guns? Did they not? They didn't trust us, I guess, huh?
If they got angry, they themselves would say, And they never got angry with me, but the men that I talked to who they had been angry with, if they became angry, they would say, do you think we're fools? Do you think we can't protect ourselves? Do you think we come here unarmed? I knew a CIA guard that told me that one day he was escorting the teacher down the steps of the Capitol building, and she was disguised to look like a human, and so she was wearing, but she was wearing, the shoes she was wearing had flat heels or low heels. And because they're frailer than we are, they walked somewhat differently than we do. And as they were coming down the steps, and he was walking beside her, he wasn't used to the way that they walked down steps.
Mm-hmm.
He was afraid that she was going to fall and hurt herself. And so without thinking, he reached over and grabbed her by the elbow to stabilize.
Uh-oh, big mistake, huh?
To stabilize her. And he said that she became, you know, their nervous system runs like two or three times faster than And he said she became instantly angry, pulled out the little white pencil microwave device that she carried under her sleeve, and had him down on his knees like a dog, you know, giving him like the electric shock treatment, saying, do you think we're fools? Do you think we can't protect ourselves? Do you think I'd walk down these steps if I couldn't take care of myself? And by the time she finished with him, it was nothing but yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. And he was so terrified of her that you can't, and even though she, you know, was apparently a nice, ordinary lady, he was so terrified of ever upsetting her, even though he was still assigned to guard her, that...
Speak up, Charles.
He was so terrified of ever upsetting her that I just don't have words to describe it. And he thought that I was the bravest person in the world just to be willing to stand in the same room as that lady and talk with her, even though he was the guard that was assigned to protect her.
You had mentioned that they had they met a ward with the Greys, for example. How many different species do you think of extraterrestrials there might be out there?
Well, in my books, you'll see I've personally met two, the tall whites on which the books are based. But in book three, I describe the Norwegians, with what I call the Norwegians with 24 teeth that I've personally met. And I believe they come from, I know they come from one of the nearby stars, the either Bernard star or the next star out, LAST. I know they come from a brown dwarf star. And the ones I describe as the Norwegians with 24 teeth are so much like us that if my dentist hadn't first shown me the x-rays of the guy's teeth, I would have never figured out that he wasn't human. And that was in Madison, Wisconsin in the fall of 1962. So I'm personally certain of two. And I know that I've never met a little gray, but I know that Roswell was the little grays crashing their craft. So that's three. I note that a study done in 1949 by the U.S. Army of the medic, which wasn't classified at the time, of the medical records at Auschwitz, asked the question, if you took the position that some human defects weren't humans but were extraterrestrials, how many extraterrestrials died in Auschwitz? And in the 1949 study published in the spring in a book that I used to read when I was a kid, when I was young, it concluded that there were nine different kinds of extraterrestrials put to death in the Nazi prison camp and death chambers. The largest group was people with 24 teeth that were found in southern Norway and northern Europe and Denmark. There were like 5,562 of them or something, and which matches directly, and I'm certain that what I call the Norwegians with 24 teeth is that group, because one of the ones that I was talking to said that his mother's father had been put to death in the camps, and that when his parents arrived with him and his mother discovered that her father was dead, she was extremely distraught and upset, and it took her like a long time to get over it. And so if you count those, you know, I would conclude that if it were me, I would put the number at 11 or 12.
At least. Paula, what would you say if you met one of the tall whites?
Well, first of all, I don't think I could say anything. I mean, I would have the same reaction of terror and panic that Charles had. I mean, it was a long time before he communicated with these people. I think that one thing I would do, though, George, is have the respect for the fact that they are different from me and not do anything that would be, you know, any reaction. I would like to act instead of react. In fact, I just wrote about this. If we could get used to this idea, then we wouldn't react and we wouldn't go crazy and we wouldn't resemble, as Charles said, the gorilla. We would be respectful, stand still, try to figure out what to do. And how, we need to know this, because I think that if this is the case, if this is really the case, some of these people are walking around.
Well, that may be. And it may be, Charles, where they may not look human, but would we look twice at them? I mean, do they fit in that closely?
If when throughout most of their adult life, especially the young women, are equivalent to, say, humans 19, 20, 21, it is possible for them to dress up to look human, so human, that if you saw them on the streets of Las Vegas, you would just think that they were like one of the showgirls.
Yeah, or some. Yeah, exactly.
And when I asked the teacher how I should react when they came, the teacher herself said that what they wanted was for us to enjoy being around them while they were here, as opposed to, you know, always picking or, you know, asking questions or pursuing. And so, because when they came for the fun of it. You know, I mean, they were stationed up at the base, and when they came in around, like in Las Vegas, when they went into the city or when they came in around humans, it's because they were bored and they wanted to have a good time.
That's an amazing story. Let's go back to the phones, Charles. First-time caller line, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
Hey, this is Randy calling from Nashville.
Go for it, Randy.
Just wanted to first say I'm not an evolution believer, but as that is the accepted theory commonly, why would all of these aliens from other planets, virtually every common story you hear, the grays and the whites, why do they share similar features such as eyes, heads, you know, body structure, they stand upright and everything, and, you know, they can hear. Why would they have all the same senses and, you know, be that similar to us if they're on some other evolutionary scale, if evolution was true?
Well, the part of the seed, I would guess, Charles, is the same everywhere, isn't it?
Well, consider that space really isn't anywhere near as big as what we're led to believe from the point of view of geological time. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old. And consider, for example, the meteor crater in Arizona, which I guess geologists say hit, I don't know, 10 million years ago or something. Well, the explosion that would have generated would have been a steam explosion, not a volcanic explosion, and therefore it would have blasted huge quantities of genetic material, not just off the Earth, but out of the solar system. And that blast, being a steam blast, would not have heated the material high enough to destroy the DNA. And the velocities that blast would have, you know, those particles would have been propelled out at velocities greater than American spacecraft achieved. And that means that in just a few years, like 10,000 or 70,000 years, all that material blasted off the Earth would be falling on planets around nearby stars. And that's just in a few thousand years, with 4.5 billion years to work from, and with meteors hitting not just all the planets in our solar system, Mars, the Moon, and so on, but hitting all the planets in other solar systems, you have a mechanism there for scattering DNA material all over the stars on this side of the galaxy. So it wouldn't be a surprise if you found strawberry plants here on Earth that looked just like equivalent strawberry plants on another planet, perhaps modified a little bit by evolution, but, you know, the same way that the plants in Australia are in many ways similar to the plants in, say, Africa, because there's, you know, from the point of view of geological time and the amount of time span that goes by in evolution, well, gee, you could be just the natural processes could be scattering DNA material all over the place. If you, many viruses or many of those, you know, many of those simpler organisms, like, you know, that carry DNA, they can be quick frozen, you know, like the blast would throw them out into space where they'd be quick frozen. And then if they fall into a warm ocean on an Earth-like planet on some distant star, they'll just start up again. You know, that doesn't kill the DNA at all.
All right. Hey, east of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on with us. Hi there.
Hi. My name's Tom. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Hi, Tom. Go ahead. Snowy New Jersey, no doubt, huh?
Yes, sir. I have a question for Charles.
Sure.
I was curious if these beings ran into any other races like ours, like human race, anywhere else, and if they had any mammals or anything similar to dogs or anything like that, where they come from?
I believe I understood your question. You have such a soft voice that I maybe didn't hear quite all the words. But when I talked with the teacher, on the one, she was like any human mother. She was concerned that her daughter, which was her only child, that her daughter would grow up with friends who were little girls like her, and that she would get used to being a little girl. And so she used to like to have her daughter play with the human little girl, just so that it was two little girls playing together. And that implied that they had many of the same emotional reactions that we do. On the other hand, the tall whites themselves did not keep pets or did not had no interest in keeping pets. They were plant eaters. Some of my friends reported seeing them collect plant seeds and stuff up in the mountains, but they didn't go around collecting animals. Now, when I talked with the teacher, she said that that their experience with other inhabited planets was that from their point of view, the Earth was unique in that we keep animals, that we are the intelligent species, but we try to think like a horse, think like a cow. Her example was that I grew up in a farm in Wisconsin. I know how to milk cows and how to ride horses. And of course, she pointed out that all those animals, and I make friends with dogs, they're nice pets. And she pointed out that all those animals could kill me anytime they wanted to, but that doesn't bother me because I've learned to think like they do. And so our bond between animals is much stronger than what you see on other planets, according to the teacher.
Paula, as we wrap up, and Charles, too, we may be able to squeeze a call in or two. I'm not sure how quickly we can. But, Paula, your book, Connecting the Dots, how do you get that?
Well, you can get it on Amazon.com for a very short time. You get it on my website, and you can get it from Fifth World Publishing. I wanted to add one thing really quickly, George. These are not the only alien races that are like us. I did some research on the Billy Meyer case and the Pleiadians, and so far there are many races that are like us, including the Native Americans believe that their ancestors came from the stars. So you have to look at the entire history of ufology, the entire history, to understand that this may be only one race that is out there.
And Charles, Millennial Hospitality Suites, how do you find it?
You can get it from Amazon.com or from links on Paula's website or from links on my website. My website is https://members.lycos.co.uk/Charles_Hall. Or if you do a search for Millennial Hospitality, it'll bring them up. But it's available, like Paula's book, it's available at bookstores anywhere in the world.
Well, I got to tell you, fascinating story indeed. Paula, thank you for being on the program.
Well,
Charles, thank you as well.
Uh-huh. Thanks.
All right, you take care of yourself. I mean, it's an incredible story, absolutely, that they're out there at Nellis Air Force Base, and also just hidden away, just simply hidden away in the mountains. Makes you wonder, doesn't it?